Webster's Dictionary defines compliance as the action or fact of complying with a wish or command. This is the Compliance Guy.
The Compliance Guy.
As a healthcare provider or healthcare professional, navigating the muddy waters of compliance can get tricky.
And that's why we're here.
Helping you mitigate risk while increasing your profitability. This is the Compliance Guy. Now, here's your host, Sean Weiss.
All right, everybody, welcome to this episode of The Compliance Guy. As always, I want to begin by saying thank you all so much for tuning in, logging on, and just hanging out with me for a little while as I get an opportunity to explore my favorite topic, compliance. So today, I have a little different segment that we're going to explore. And I think the timing of this couldn't be better. Given everything that is going on in our industry right now with chemical dependence, substance abuse, the opioid crisis that has become an epidemic of this country, and really trying to balance all of these negative things that are going on in our country surrounding the opioids with helping providers to understand how they remain compliant, how they do things, you know, accurately. And in the event somebody comes and knocks on their door and says, lift the hood, we want to take a look at what you have under the hood. I have an individual joining me today who I think has kind of cracked the code. And I want to tell you a little bit about who's joining me today. And I want to just quickly tell you a little bit about their organization and what they do. So today I have Dan Cohen, who is joining me from Pain Scripts. And this is a company that really connects physicians with their chronic pain substance use disorder patients. And they do it on a daily basis by tracking medication and care plan adherence through a clinically validated app. So what essentially happens is physicians are provided with a detailed patient, you know, insight, or I should say the physicians are provided with detailed patient insight via their HIPAA compliant clinical dashboard, as well as additional tools for medication monitoring. And what's really neat about the program for me is that it uses real-time data and daily digital care, so patients are more engaged in their health. And we all know that having highly educated patients, having patients that are engaged in their care plan, results in better outcomes. So a little bit about Dan, and we'll kind of get into this more. Dan really has spent a ton of time since really 1979 in Washington, D.C., and has experience in various senior level government relation positions. Prior to his roles, Dan served as a senior executive with several medical device and healthcare corporations, including U.S. Oncology, McKesson, the largest U.S. national oncology physician provider network, and really cut his teeth in the medical device and aesthetics background. So with that said, you know, I could go on for probably 10 minutes talking about Dan's fascinating background and just how cool it is to have him on the program. But I want y'all to hear from Dan himself. And you know, what I'm looking forward to is he's a very good storyteller. And I think he's got a great story to tell. And I think it's something that is so critical that those of you who are not clinicians, you're going to want to get your providers to listen to this episode, especially if they are prescribers of opioids. All right. So with that said, Dan, welcome to the program. So good to have you. Thank you for being here today and taking time out of your busy schedule.
Sean, I appreciate it. It was a wonderful introduction, and we could end the show right there and say, yes, let's do that and move on. But I suspect we have more stories to tell today as we go forward.
I think we absolutely do have some more stories to tell. So, you know, could you, you know, quickly give our audience a bit of an understanding about really your background, how you found yourself working in healthcare, and more specifically, what drove you to the place that you're at right now with Pain Scripts.
Well, what drove me to healthcare, frankly, was nearly over 30 years ago. I left my training field, which is foreign policy in general, the Middle East in particular, and had a crisis management firm. Within a short period of time, my book of business, half of it or more, was healthcare agencies. They were always in crisis, whether it's with Congress, the regulatory agencies, CMS, FDA. And I really started to develop a background in these particular areas. One of my clients came to me in March of 99 and asked me to help them solve a problem as an outside consultant. It was Purdue Pharma, and OxyContin abuse in Maine was just starting to appear. And the company politely was aghast. They didn't know what was going on. They had created what they thought was a good product, a better product, especially for chronic care patients. And yet abusers had found a way to defeat the medical benefit of the product to the detriment of society as a whole. And what that did is it got me involved in pain management as a core issue. You know, 30 million Americans today suffer from chronic pain issues to the extent that it interferes with their daily life and their ability to function, to play with their grandkids, to go to work, to sleep at night. And they're under some form of treatment. And when I say a chronic patient, by definition, chronic patients are people that we generally don't expect to get well, that they're going to be dealing with this in some manner for the rest of their lives. And so we have to treat these people appropriately, and we can do that with the products that are on the market today. Yet at the same time, as we all know, these powerful drugs are very beneficial for a pain patient, can be very detrimental to someone that's using them for recreational purposes, for abuse, and there's got to be a balancing act. It's not as if physicians didn't have something that they're not using. The human animal responds to three types of analgesic generally: aspirin, NSAID, and opioid. There isn't a fourth option out there that will solve your pain and not have the risks that are associated with any of these three drugs. And aspirins and NSAIDs are also significant health risks if misused.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's interesting that you brought up OxyContin, because, you know, there's actually been some really incredible documentaries that were put out there on this drug, and really Purdue Pharma and what did they know? What didn't they know? What did they disclose? What didn't they disclose? You know, and if some of the folks listening are interested, there was a very good documentary in 2021 on HBO. It was called The Crime of the Century. There was another one that was put out as well. It's called Dope Sick. Yep. And the third one is a Netflix documentary all about OxyContin called Painkiller. And these three documentaries take very different approaches to the same issue, the same problem. And, you know, I love the fact that you brought up Maine, because what a lot of folks don't recognize, or, you know, don't maybe realize, is that the opioid crisis really manifested itself in New England. Yep. And that is where the genesis of the drug problems, you know, or the addiction problems, I shouldn't say the drug problems, but the addiction problems really started. And it started right around that 1999, like you said, you know, with the OxyContin and kind of what was going on there.
Well, and we also have to keep a perspective. I'm not going to, dismiss Purdue's responsibility in what was going on, and they certainly had a role. But it would also be way too easy to say, well, this was the one problem, the one bad actor, and but for them, we wouldn't have this crisis. That wouldn't be accurate either.
Oh, and I agree with you 100%. I think there's blame to go around everywhere. And
you have to think about what we knew about pain 30 years ago compared to what we know about it today. In the mid-90s, the AMA announced that pain would be the fifth indication that physicians should look at when treating a patient, along with blood pressure, respiration, and the like. And that makes a lot of sense, because if you're going to your doctor and if you're in pain, a sharp pain means one thing, a dull ache means something else, but pain generally indicates a problem. So that seemed to make sense. But it wasn't until the year 2000 that the first medical school in the country started offering training in pain management to physicians. Prior to 2000, not a single physician in the United States in a U.S. medical school got any training in pain management. But your veterinarian got 9 hours of training at that point in time going through veterinarian school. So a lot of physicians didn't know what they didn't know. And today makes us all look foolish back in 95, 2005, 2015, because we're learning so much more about pain, how to treat it, how to responsibly treat it, and how to assess the needs of our patients.
Yeah, it's we're dealing really, in my opinion, with a 27-headed monster, because I think what happens is there are those providers out there who unfortunately are bad actors. There are,
yes, in every field there are bad actors.
Absolutely, in every field, but we're specifically talking about healthcare, right? Yep. So, you know, for me, I look at the vast majority of providers. 95 to 97% of providers are good, hardworking, caring individuals who took an oath to do no harm. And
the only way I'll disagree with you, Sean, is, yeah, I think the number is closer to 99% are,
and it very well could be, you know, the reason why I use, you know, the 95 to 97% is because over my 30-year career, you know, and especially over the last two decades, you know, I have been actively involved in litigation. You know, my job is to serve either as a consulting or testifying expert, either for the government or for defense, depending on who gets to me first and whether or not, you know, I believe, you know, the prosecution has done their diligence and the individuals that they want to prosecute or not want to prosecute, but the individuals that they are obligated to prosecute truly are those who deserve to be prosecuted versus, yep, whether those who are being accused of committing a crime genuinely committed that crime or there's a misperception, a misunderstanding. So for me, you know, I've always said, you know, the error rate, as people like to talk about, you know, or the margin of error is plus or minus 5%. So I always come in and say, you know, 95 to 97% of all providers out there want to do the right thing. They're good, hardworking, honest people. You know, in the opioid area, I don't think I could disagree with you as I'm thinking through it. There's probably 1% of providers who are the bad actors when it comes to misprescribing or failing to do right by the patients because, you know, their hand is you know, led by greed. And I think that's what happens, right? You know, and that's where these pill mills come from. It's not because, sure, they want to see people getting high. It's not because they want to hurt people. It's greed. It's American greed. And at least that's my perspective.
I can't disagree with that. I mean, the whole interaction between licit and illicit drugs, you know, there is a nexus to it, and we have to figure it out. Not as much for the patient or non-patient who is harmed by the illicit activity, but to make sure we're preserving appropriate treatment options for patients that need physician care.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with you. So, you know,
let's go on with our story.
Yeah, let's keep going.
So what we've done at PainScript is we did something that's simple. And what's simple is that something a physician learns in their first 2 weeks in med school, the more often you touch a patient, the better the outcome is going to be. And that became an important mantra for us. We wanted to find a way for patients to be able to interact with their physician with the entire goal of getting a better outcome for their treatment. Because of our involvement in pain and substance use disorders, which are closely related, those were our first verticals for our company that they were looking at. And what we wanted to do was to increase medication compliance, take the appropriate drug as prescribed at the right amount of time, and we wanted to improve care plan adherence, you know, doing what your doctor wants you to do. The problem we have in society today is that patients just can't seem to do that on their own, especially chronic patients. Because remember our definition at the start of this show, a chronic patient is someone that's going to be treated in most cases for the rest of their life. Now, there may be some exceptions that prove the rule, but chronic care is long-term treatment of patients. And the farther away you get from diagnosis, the less compliant patients are with their care plans and their medication. What does that mean for society? It's costing us, each and every one of us in the U.S. healthcare system, over $600 billion, that's with a B, that's a big number, in lost compliance a year. What does that translate into? More ER visits, 125,000 excess deaths that occur, patients that are sicker than they otherwise should be, requiring more health care than they otherwise would need if they were more compliant with their care plan. So everything we do is focused around having the patient communicate with their physician every day for a brief moment. Our platform requires 20 seconds of patient involvement a day. What they're getting is a clinical question or series of three clinical questions each and every day. They have the ability to send a secure message to their physician. The questions change every day. The values, the background that are set in the background give the physician actionable information. It allows the physician to practice the art as well as the science of medicine. And the patient has their doctor sitting on their shoulder, whispering in their ear functionally every day, you know, Sean, I'm treating you for a reason. You have a problem. If you do what I say, you will do better than if you don't. And with the increased compliance, we're reducing costs on the system and we're improving outcomes with patients. People would like to say there's a silver bullet. We don't have a silver bullet. We just have common sense solutions, and we've found an actionable way to get that done for the physician in his office in a very automated form. And patients do better when they use our platform.
You know, it's interesting that you brought up outcomes, because obviously, you know, we have seen a dynamic shift in the way that physicians are looked at and also compensated under certain programs, both from a commercial perspective and from a government reimbursement perspective. Yeah. Outcomes are a huge measure of a provider in some cases. If they're part of an ACO, what are your outcomes? You know, are you keeping the patients out of the hospital? Are you keeping the patients clean and sober? Are you keeping your patients healthy? All of these different measurements that providers are being held to. You know, and you and I, go ahead.
But that's real simple, Sean. I mean, that's what a patient wants. They want outcomes. We go to a doctor to get treated, to get better than we would be otherwise. And it's a fair measurement to ask a physician to, through their treatment plan, for the patient to do better than they would otherwise. And if we're not doing that, then what are we talking about?
Yeah.
So it's an appropriate move in healthcare, I believe.
Yeah. And I think it is as well. You know, let me ask you this question. Because, you know, you've been around healthcare for a long time. I know you said since 1979, you've been involved in some way, shape, or form from a regulatory standpoint, whatever it's been. One of the things I have noticed over my career in being both a physician liaison, working in government affairs, working on the Hill for a period of time, working as a compliance officer, doing the kind of work that I do now. I think one of the things that kind of backed physicians into a corner, and you tell me if I'm wrong, one of the things that I feel may have backed physicians into a corner is that patients felt like if they went to the doctor and they didn't walk out of there with some kind of prescription for something to treat a symptom or a sign, even if it wasn't treating the underlying, you know, condition, but it was treating the symptoms or signs, the patients felt like they were getting ripped off. I mean, what do you think about that?
I think there's a lot of truth to that, unfortunately, in that patients expect something. They would like everything that they're being treated for to have an immediate answer, an aha moment. If you do this, if you take this pill, if you don't eat this food, whatever the circumstances, your problem will go away. And unfortunately, not a lot of healthcare is that simple. We'll take something that's very simple. You see patients going down to emergency care and getting a Z-Pak every time they have a viral infection.
That's right.
Well, those are two things that don't work together, and they actually set a patient up for worse outcomes down the road when they do need a Z-Pak, because it doesn't work as effectively if you've been continually taking them. Yet we're in a situation where because of costs, because of patient expectations, that no one is saying no. I'll give you a different example from my career. There was a drug that is used as adjuvant care for women that have breast cancer, Avastin. And for women that express the appropriate version of the HER2 gene, it is a very good outcome to add that to their chemotherapy care. 45% of women expressed the gene. At the time that I was working on the Avastin issue for U.S. Oncology, nearly 70% of women treated for breast cancer were getting Avastin. Mm-hmm. Why? Because they went on the internet and they saw that it was important. And physicians weren't able to stand up to it. Now, a simple, at that time, $20 genetic test could have proved whether Avastin was an appropriate inclusion for that patient or not. But the commercial payers didn't want to pay for that $20 test, yet a dose of Avastin at that point was costing over $2,000. It was the number one spend drug that CMS covered every year. And so we have this entirely upside down system that goes exactly to your point. People want to get treated. Physicians sometimes get boxed in the corner. For those half of the women that got Avastin where it was doing them no benefit, it was also doing them no harm. But it was doing harm to the healthcare system because there was a lot of money being spent for women that were getting a therapy that at best was neutral to their healthcare.
Yeah. And that's what's frightening. I think for whatever reason, well, I know the reason, everybody runs to Dr. Google. Yep. And that's the problem that we have. On last week's episode of our Monday auditing, coding, and compliance roundtable, one of my guests, Terry Fletcher, was talking about this exact situation, right? And, you know, she had a client that she was waiting to meet with, and while she's sitting in the reception area alongside of other patients, you could hear the doctor in the back yelling at the Alexa, who for whatever reason he was dependent on, saying, "Alexa, for a patient that has blah, 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 can I prescribe this?" And the Alexa was saying, according to WebMD, this drug should be used. And his patients are literally sitting there. So, you know, I think we have problems on both sides with some of the younger generation physicians maybe that are coming out now relying on more technology than what they were trained to do in medical school. I mean, I know we're getting a little off topic on this, but think about this. How many medical schools, and I think this only leads to more problems down the road. How many medical schools, these Ivy League schools, have done away with the requirement for the MCAT?
Right.
Did you ever believe that a individual could get into medical school without having to take an MCAT?
It's a stunning situation to a number of degrees, because science, by and large, is an empirical study. So it's not discriminatory against any group of people based on anything other than the empirics of, do you have the math and science background to answer the question? And so it becomes frustrating. But also the way we deliver healthcare today contributes to that. I mean, when I grew up, Dr. Wheelwright lived down the road. He carried a black bag. He came to the house. He mixed his own vaccines, took a needle that had a gauge the size of Wisconsin to stick it in your tush. But that was the way healthcare was delivered when I was a kid. Sorry. Today, you get to see your physician for 8 to 10 minutes. If you're a chronic patient, which means you're going to see your physician regularly, with the exception of pain, that regularly means every 60 to 90 days. With pain, if you're on a scheduled substance, it's every 30 days with some variations because of the public health emergency on COVID that are still in place where we can extend it to 90 days. But think about that, an 8 to 10 minute window for the physician to come in, diagnose, analyze, and treat whatever's happening. And then the next time the patient comes in, it's Sean, how you doing? Well, if you're anything like me, I'd have trouble telling you what I had for breakfast yesterday, much less what happened to me over the last 90 days. But you know, physicians know this. They know that when they ask the patient how you're doing, you're going to find out about the last 48 hours or the acute event that brought you in. We tried to move away from that. So with our platform, the questions that the patients answer every day, those three questions, three doesn't sound like much, but at the end of 30, 60, 90 days, you have 90, 180, 270 data points that shows the progression of the patient on both direct and indirect metrics. The physician can take a look at that data and see that while you're a pain patient, Sean, so your pain level's fine, your fatigue level, but you've noted most of the time you're unable to do what you want to be able to do. And you're taking substances to help you sleep. Is that substance a glass of Chardonnay or is it an Ambien? It changes the nature of the appointment because we can focus in on the issues that are concerning you. We can get early warning in the physician's office. So if they know that something is going south, but you haven't decided that you want to call your physician yet, that data will appear and the physician's office can proactively reach out to you and say, you know, Sean, your anxiety level and your craving levels have shot up over the last 2 weeks. What's going on? Do we need to get you in to try and solve this? It's better medicine and more targeted treatment. And all of that data is captured automatically for the practice. So when you have a chance to look at the record and audit it, the physician's practice will know every member of his care team, what they did, when they did it, and how they treated that patient to reach the best outcomes. It's, again, better medicine. We haven't done anything that is new and exciting. We've found a way to formalize the process so that practices can end up offering their patients better care without investing significant additional time in it and no additional time from the physician unless the patient has a clinical issue that rises to the physician level.
You know, one of the things as you were going through, you know, the last bit that you were talking about, a couple of things jumped out at me, right? So I see a program like yours being very beneficial to a defense counsel for a prescriber of opioids, in that we have a trail. We have an audit trail. Yep. We know the when, the where, the how, the why, all the way down to the second that something was entered into the system. So, you know, for people like myself who get called to testify, you know, I can talk about keystroke entries. I could talk about who's touching the medical record? How often are they touching it? When are they touching it? Why are they touching it? What's being input? What's being adjusted in the system? And, you know, let me ask you this question, Dan. Have you and or pain scripts ever been used as part of the defense for a provider trying to show that, hey, I am practicing good medicine, and here's the proof?
Well, ours at this point, we've been in the reverse. We are providing services to providers that want to make sure that all of their actions are documented.
Right.
And let me give you a use case as an example as to what current practices is for most practices in pain management and how the addition of our platform improves that process. So current practice, you're going to be my patient, Sean. You've come to me for the first time. You have chronic pain from a spinal cord injury. So this is something that is debilitating without treatment. And you've come to me for the first time, and I may appropriately prescribe, because we want to titrate patients and start them at the lowest effective dose, with 10 milligrams of OxyContin twice daily. I'll want you to do some exercises to loosen the musculature around your back to give you some relief. Then we're going to stay in touch, and we're going to see each other every 30 days. We're going to meet the standard guidelines that Congress adopted in 2017. And we meet every 30 days. We talk about how you're doing in that 8 to 10 minute session. And for the first 5 months, things are looking pretty good. When we treat a pain patient, we don't get them out of pain. We get their pain down to a manageable level so that they can function. So you have to set expectations right. And your pain is to a manageable level. You're able to do your podcasts on a regular basis. You're able to go to work. You're able to play with your grandkids. Everything that you want out of life. You're sleeping. Your fatigue levels are under control. This is all a good thing. Month 6 comes around. Pain levels go up. Fatigue levels go up. Work attendance goes down. You've had to postpone a couple of podcasts. I might conclude when we come into that sixth meeting, that sixth data point, that you've plateaued on a dose of 10 milligrams of OxyContin. And my first titration attempt might be to raise your dose to 20 milligrams twice daily. If your values then fall back into that normative range that we're looking for, that you're able to go to work and everything goes back to the last 5 months, I've made a good medical decision. And I reached that decision. This is the state of care today on 6 data points with a total of 50 to 60 minutes of spending time with you over 6 months. So that's the standard of care today. If you add our platform onto that standard of care, not only do you have those same 6 data points, but you have up to 540 additional data points from those 3 daily questions. We've asked about your pain levels 4 or 5 times a month. We've asked about fatigue. We've asked about work attendance. We've asked subjective as well as objective questions. And now looking at the trending lines, I have a much better idea of when you started to fail on the treatment pattern, what the issues were that caused the failure. And I may come up with the same answer, that 20 milligrams of OxyContin because you had an opiate plateau is the correct diagnosis. But now I've got all this rich information to look at. And if a non-healthcare regulatory agency were to come to my office and say, in this case, the DEA, Dan, why did you double the dose to this patient? I said, well, the reason I did it is for these 540 data points on top of my 6 face-to-face meetings over the last 6 months. This was clearly an appropriate medical decision well within the bounds of appropriate healthcare. Right now, the DEA is looking at how much MMEs, how many morphine equivalents have I given the patient? And if it's above 80 MME, I am automatically suspect of having done something wrong. Using our platform, now the DEA really is put in a position that was mandated by Ruan versus the U.S. that they have to prove I'm operating outside of the standard of care. Our platform proves that they're operating within the standard of care. Now, if they're a pill mill, Our platform will also prove that they're operating outside of the standard of care, but I don't think they're going to retain our services.
Yeah, bad actors aren't looking to be compliant. So
they are not.
I agree with you. And you know, one of the things that I love that you brought up is Ruan v. United States.
Yes.
And this was such a landmark case, and in my humble opinion, I think Justice Breyer saved his greatest writing for his last case, where he was the majority opinion in the case. I thought his analysis was brilliant. I thought his writing
majority opinion for a 9-0 decision.
For a 9-0 decision. Yeah.
Which is that's unusual by itself in this
court. It is, given the split of the court on so many critical issues. But this was one where every single justice was aligned. And, you know, if you as the listeners were paying close attention to what Dan was saying, he was talking about generally accepted standards of medical practices, what we refer to. And what happened in all of these opioid cases that I have been working on and that I was testifying in, and this is the most fascinating one. In one of the cases, and I think you and I are both well acquainted with an attorney by the name of Ronald Chapman II.
Yep.
And
brilliant attorney. Really
absolutely brilliant. He is the Fred Astaire of a courtroom. To watch him navigate both his direct and cross examinations, I've rarely seen another who can do what he does. But what was so fascinating in the case that I was on with him is right before the judge in the case in Detroit, Michigan, that I was on, was giving the jury instructions, the ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court from SCOTUS was handed down on Ruan, and it forever has now changed the landscape for prosecutors in how they make determinations as to whether to bring a prosecution or not against the provider, because they have to be able to look at whether or not the prescribing was outside of the standards of normal care. And that is such a difficult task now to prove that a provider, unless they're a pure pill mill, but it's an insurmountable task to demonstrate and prove that a provider was prescribing outside of normal standards. And it's been a tremendous benefit to providers at this point.
It is a tremendous benefit to providers, but more importantly, it's also a tremendous benefit to the American jurisprudence system, because think about at the core what Ron was asking the court to rule on. They were asking to say that it's the responsibility of the prosecutor to prove that a crime was being committed, not the responsibility of the physician to prove that they were innocent.
Absolutely.
Because that's every other part of American jurisprudence. And is that a high bar? Sure.
Sure.
But it's supposed to be a high bar in America.
It is. And I'll tell you the other winners of Ruan.
Patients.
Absolutely.
Because patients.
Because think about how many patients.
No, I was going to say patients need their doctor to look at.
Go ahead, please.
Need their doctor to look at their situation and use their training and experience and skills to treat them the best they know how. And that won't happen if the physician is also looking over his shoulder and saying, how is this treatment going to look to someone that has no experience in medicine?
Yeah. Listen,
that's wrong.
Look, I have family members that were unfortunately injured and, you know, seriously injured and mm-hmm. needed, you know, a breakthrough, you know, narcotic to, and you know, several of the doctors were like, I can only give you 7 days. I can only give you, you know, this amount. I'm not running the risk of getting audited. I mean, now with Ruan, we're seeing more providers starting to look at it and say, okay, I can go back to objective medicine. I can go back to doing what I know for my patient. So ultimately, the patients were the biggest winners. The jurisprudence of our country was the second biggest winner, and providers were third.
And we also need to think about how we get advancements in healthcare. You know, as someone that developed drugs and developed devices in the private sector, you know, we like to think that we are the ones causing advances in healthcare, and that's really not true. We're providing the service to the providers. It's when the provider, with experience and looking at dozens of patients with the same illness pattern and coming up with different treatments by saying, you know, let's try something different. There's sometimes unexpected benefits from drugs that are developed for one purpose and end up providing another benefit. Now, the best example of that in modern times is Pfizer was making a drug for high altitude mountaineering. I'm a high altitude mountaineer. I climb big mountains over 18,000 feet. Wow. And this drug was designed to increase red blood cell production and uptake of oxygen. But Pfizer also noted a very significant side effect among the male mountaineers, and a little blue pill was born. So from an orphan drug for a few thousand people, there was an entire industry with Viagra. And that's okay, because that's what's supposed to happen in medicine. Physicians are supposed to look at drugs that are designed for one thing and try something else and see if it works. And they do it based on their skill and their experience. And yes, there's going to be mistakes on occasion, and that's why we have guardrails for that. But physicians shouldn't be penalized for trying to do something different and unique, whether it's a pain patient or a substance use disorder patient or an obesity patient or any other type of thing. You know, free practice of medicine with the inherent risk and rewards is important to advance healthcare in society, my view.
And I agree with you. And that's why they call it the art of medicine, or they call it the practice of medicine. And it's so funny you brought up the little blue pill. I was in my late 20s, early 30s, and I was asked to come and deliver a keynote address in Aspen, Colorado. And I got there and I felt fine, you know, when I landed in Denver, and then to drive up the mountain as we got higher and higher. And then I get to the hotel. It was really interesting. They asked me where I was from, and I explained to them I was from, and they said, would you like a humidifier? And I said, for what? And they explained to me, because I was, you know, young and naive. I was a rookie. And I was like, yeah, sure. Okay. Sounds good. So got to my room, and about 35 to 40 minutes after I got to my room, I just did not feel good. The entire bottom felt like it was starting to fall out from underneath me. And long story short, I called down to the front desk and I was like, hey, listen, I don't know what it is. I feel really sick. You guys have a house doctor that I can, you know, and they said, absolutely, we have a house doctor. We'll go here on premises, because this happened all the time. Sure enough, the doctor came up to my room and he said, you've got altitude sickness, Sean. He said, I'm going to give you something called Viagra. And I had heard of Viagra, and I was like, I don't need Viagra. I'm fine. I'm, you know, not even 30 years old yet. Or maybe I was 30. And he goes, no. And I think he actually said, no, dummy. This is to treat the vessels, to open up the vessels to allow blood flow to your entire body, because it's being deprived of red blood, you know, red blood cells and oxygen. And that was my first and one and only experience with Viagra. And I remember calling my wife and I was like, hey, they gave me the blue pill. And she's like, wait, what? And I had to explain to her. So that kind of gave us a good chuckle for a little while. But I agree with your assessment. I mean, you know, folks like yourself, who are the engineers, the developers, the scientists behind the technological advancements that we see, are one aspect of how we advance healthcare. It is the providers being able to use their skills as the treating physician, to use their clinical judgment, to evaluate a patient in their entirety, not just in a vacuum, as a lot of prosecutors do, or a lot of agents for the DEA. They look at one or two episodes of care as opposed to looking at the entire episode of care for the patient.
Right.
And letting physicians be physicians, letting them be scientists, letting them look at data, which is the other point that you raised. And I say this all the time on my podcast. Data is king. The more the more data you have at your fingertips, the better you are for educating your patients, for defending yourself, and for helping to advance the practice of medicine. That's my take on it.
And what it comes down to is, who are we doing this for? Because if we're honest, in most disease states, 85, 90, maybe even 95% of the patients can be treated with a quick call to Alexa. I mean, the care is standard. It's simple. It's straightforward. We don't need a doctor for this. We need Dr. AI for this. I'm saying this sarcastically.
Oh, I know you are.
But, you know, it's at the margins. On one side of the spectrum or the other, that 5-10% of patients that don't respond the way an average, put quote, air quotes in the air, the average patient should or would, where the physician who has seen this same disease state not once or twice, but hundreds of times, and recognized that there's something different about the way you're acting, Sean, with this disease, which means I have to do something different to get you with a good outcome. Because it all comes back to the core. As patients, we rely on our physicians to give us their very best. And if we're putting handcuffs on the doctors and keeping one hand tied behind their back, they're not going to be able to give us their very best. You know, they may not always get it right. I mean, there's no certitude in life except death and taxes. But giving your physician the opportunity to treat you with the best possible tools is what we're about at PainScript. We're adding an important tool, we think, to the practice of medicine, that we're allowing pain physicians. We haven't even talked about substance use disorder yet. We certainly haven't talked about obesity, areas that we're working in, but we think that our approach will not only improve outcomes, but will give physicians direct, audible, detailed records and documentation, all automatic documentation. And in many cases, these benefits are covered by insurance codes so that the physician can get paid for the work that they're doing that improves their patient's outcome.
Absolutely. Well, listen, this has been an absolutely brilliant and fascinating conversation for me. I've learned so much in the short time that you and I spent together, both, you know, getting ready to, you know, have you on the actual podcast, and now having you on the podcast and getting the opportunity to really, you know, explore further into detail just what it is that you and the good people at PainScript are working on, how you're helping physicians to advance the practice of medicine, and what you're doing to improve the overall quality of care for the patients.
Thank you.
All right. So that's going to wrap up this episode of The Compliance Guy. I want to thank my very special guest, Mr. Daniel L. Cohen from PainScripts. I will make certain that I put a link to his organization into the session description today, along with a bit about Mr. Cohen's background. So I'll include his short bio for you. As always, I want to thank each and every single one of you for taking time out of your busy schedule, for tuning in, logging on, and hanging out with me just for a little while as I get to explore the world of compliance, the world of healthcare, especially the intersection of the business of medicine and regulatory compliance. All right, I'm going to be back next week with our all-star cast for our Monday auditing, coding, and compliance roundtable. Terry Fletcher and I will be back on Tuesday with our hashtag Terry Tuesday episode. And as always, I'm sure that's going to be quite the fascinating conversation, as it always is. So until then, remember, be good to yourself, but more importantly, y'all be good to each other. Take care.
You've been listening to The Compliance Guy. Sean has been doing this for 28 years. He holds 10 national board certifications. He's a partner and the vice president of compliance for Doctors Management, LLC. He's a subject matter expert in federal court. He's lectured at the most prestigious institutions. He's engaged with members of Congress in both chambers. So what we're saying is he's qualified? We hope you've enjoyed the show. Make sure to like, rate, and review. And we'll be back soon. But in the meantime, you can find us on social media at The Compliance Guy. See you next time on The Compliance Guy.